Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. It is great to have you here on this beautiful May weekend. At least it's beautiful where I am. I hope it's beautiful where you are too. We're going to spend an hour looking at the world through the lens of children's rights, through the lens of what would the world be like if we put children first, and evaluating some trending news that intersects with marriage and family life. But first, as always, we're going to kick things off with a little bit of Bible time. And I will tell you that my mom heart is absolutely delighted these days because I have my second daughter home from college. My first is married and heading off to create a new life with her husband. My two younger boys are at home with me. And so my second child, my daughter, who's a freshman in college, is back for the summer. And we have been having so much fun together. Working out, cooking, cleaning, and my favorite thing, reading the Bible together at coffee shops. So this week we got together and we decided to start Philippians, which is such a classic. And after we finished chapter one, you know, she looked at me, which is so funny because I always say this to other people when I read the Bible with them. She goes, "So how does that speak to you, Mom?" And I said, "What amazes me about Paul and his writing is he didn't have any earthly children, but he talks like a dad. He talks like a parent. So many of the things that he says that he wants for his spiritual children perfectly mirror exactly what I want for my children. And, you know, he talks about how I long for you with all the affection of Christ Jesus. And that's how I feel. Like, I just long to be with my kids, my teens and my adult children. And he talks about like what he prays for them for, and he doesn't pray that they are healed of physical ailments, and he doesn't pray that they're materially wealthy. He prays that your love may abound still more and more in the real knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve the things that are excellent in order to be sincere and blameless until the day of Christ." I'm like, check, 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 check. That's what I want for my children. I don't want them to be duped. I don't want them to be fools. I don't want them to be wicked. I want them to be pure and wise and blameless. Anyway, it was just a sweet, sweet time. I encourage you, whatever age your children are, read the Bible with them. Get through a chapter or maybe just a verse if they're little and say, "What does that verse mean to you?" And just let them start talking. And a lot of times you learn not only about that verse, not only about the Lord, but you learn about your kids too. I am joined by my engagement director, Patience Sunny, who's going to hit some of the headlines for me. But Patience, do you have any thoughts on Philippians 1, Bible in general, or just connecting with others through scripture?
Yeah, actually, it's fun that you're in Philippians. That's the book that I memorized on a dare in eighth grade. And, you know, not the best reason for memorizing scripture, but I am so grateful that I have so much of that book. Just readily available to call to mind. It is such an encouraging book of the Bible. And like you said, Paul really does speak like a father, despite not having earthly children of his own.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in this chapter, Paul does say some preach Christ for selfish ambition, you know, some for really good motives, some for bad motives, and some just because they got on the right side of a dare. And he's like, whatever reason, Christ is proclaimed. So that completely checks out. You absolutely get like 1,000 Philippian points or whatever you're supposed to get for memorizing the entire book, which is very, very impressive. Well, we're going to turn our time to some of the news, some of the headlines that have been in the news as it relates to marriage, family, reproductive technologies, which is what we try to cover here. Why? Not a lot of people are, and you, people who follow Christ, who love the Lord, actually need to be experts on this. So one of the big headlines that came out of last week was that there was a bombing at a fertility clinic. And this took place in Palm Springs, California. And of course, the mainstream media was like, uh-oh, it's those pro-lifers that are trying to destroy the fertility clinic because they're absolute fanatics. And it really is awful. You know, somebody parked the car out in front of the clinic, they blew it up. No embryos were harmed in the process. Thank God no staff were on site that day. But the bomber did die. So now we have more information about the person that committed this crime. So Patience, do you want to tell us a little bit about what we know about the person and the motivation that fueled this deadly attack?
Yeah, so really a tragic and horrifying situation. The attacker is a 25-year-old named Guy Bartkus, and he subscribes to an ideology. He described himself as antinatalist and pro-mortalist. So anti-birth and pro-death. And he really acted on those beliefs. So four people were injured, and the attacker died. It was a suicide attack. The four people were not on site at the fertility clinic. It was closed and empty at the time. But the blast was large enough that it affected nearby buildings. But the attacker left behind a website and a dark, rambling audio message. He actually attempted to live stream the attack, and that appears to have been unsuccessful. But on the website that he created, there was a link to this audio message describing his, quote, pro-mortalist views. And in it, on his website, Bartkus wrote, "Understand that your death is already a guarantee, and you can thank your parents for that one." So the ideology that really drove this attack was this idea that death is better than life, that life should be ended as soon as possible, and that nobody should be bringing new lives into the world. And so he targeted a fertility clinic because he saw that as a place where people are very intentionally creating lives. And so he chose to attack that clinic. There's indication on his website that he was in part motivated by his best friend Sophie's suicide. She also held to this very nihilistic, anti-natalist, pro-mortalist viewpoint. And it sounds like the two of them essentially had a suicide pact where if one of them died, the other would follow soon after. And he chose to do so in such a way that he attempted to take other lives in the process.
Well, it's sad. You know, we spend quite a bit of time kind of talking about how the reproductive technology world victimizes children. And so we are very critical of IVF. We are very critical of the big fertility world in general. We never wish harm on the people that are victimizing children in a variety of different ways, both in terms of violating their right to life and the right to their mother and father and their right to be born free and not bought and sold. But the way that we challenge that is through radio programs, through legislative initiatives, through decrying and bringing to light the human rights violations of a lot of these different doctors and clinics. But obviously, nobody should be inflicting violence or trying to carry out their aims through violence. And this person was certainly not on our side of the cultural, religious, or political fence. Let's just put it that way. But it's true that what we've got here is a young man that was really troubled. He has divorce in his background. As a teenager, he experienced his parents' divorce, incredibly destabilizing. We're going to be talking a little bit more about divorce's long-term impact on children later on in the radio segment. But you can't simply starve children of their fundamental needs. You know, at Them Before Us, we often talk about how there's three socio-emotional staples of a child's development, and it's mother's love, father's love, and stability. And if you're not feasting on all three of those every single day throughout your entire upbringing, you're going to be malnourished. You're going to be malformed. That's not to say that you can't overcome and that you can't heal from it, but you are going to be hindered, right? You're going to be hobbling, emotionally hobbling in a lot of ways. Sometimes kids are able to work that through. And sometimes, I would argue, it turns them into people who are dangerous, not just to themselves, but to others as well. So very, very sad when you see sort of the ideas about the meaninglessness of life that drove him to these deadly actions. But also, you know, as our friends at the Colson Center often say, that ideas have consequences and bad ideas have victims. And one of the bad ideas that he seemed to believe is because there is suffering in the world, which there clearly is, therefore, life is not worthy of living, and not only his own life, but that justifies taking the lives of others or preventing little lives from coming into this world or seeing a full life themselves. So really a lot to think about there. Patience, anything to add as a wrap up for that segment, for that news item?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that struck me as I was looking at this news story is that he takes to its full conclusion what the abortion industry and to an extent the fertility industry embraces on a smaller scale, where they say certain lives are not worth living because of suffering. Children who might have disabilities, children who might have a difficult upbringing, children who might have genetic conditions. And there's this attempt to prevent those lives from coming into existence and often really cutting those lives short. But he takes it a step further and he says, well, you know, if this kind of suffering makes life not worth living, then why would life be worth living in light of any kind of suffering? And he is correct in identifying that every life comes with suffering. That's the reality of living in a broken and fallen world. But he misses the fact that life is good and that there is redemptive beauty and hope in life. And it's tragic to see that he took that idea to its end. But I think it's also a very sobering reminder that we're already seeing in mainstream culture that idea being embraced just in a more isolated context.
I think that one of the things that is the most alarming to people in the marriage and family world, even just the people that are kind of moving in the realm of the theological, you know, I'm connected to the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. That's Jordan Peterson's new project that we are working to try to be a righteous inverse of the World Economic Forum. And the thing that shocks so many of the people at the very, very top is obviously things like out of control spending or authoritarianism across the globe or the birth dearth that is coming for most Western nations. But the thing that shocks them the most is the utter meaninglessness, that the lack of hope that some in the millennial and Gen Z crowd are experiencing. They feel like there's no hope in life. And a lot of this, I would argue, is because they were starved of what they needed as children, the protection they needed, the relationship, the connection, the stability. It is very hard for someone to form a stable identity, to have a stable future if they were malnourished in terms of what it takes to create children, create and then maintain and grow those children in ways where you're addressing all different aspects of not just their physical health, not just giving them, you know, vegetables and carbohydrates and fat, and but actually nourishing them on all the things that go into a healthy human existence. And, you know, I would argue because we're made in the image of God, our God is a relational God. Therefore, we are also made for relationships. We are made primarily for a relationship with the two people responsible for our existence. We should feast on their love and connection every day, all day. Obviously, at some point in his life, he was starved of, at best, 50% of his mother's love, 50% of his father's love. And we know that post-divorce, as we're going to discuss later in the radio show, stability is often completely non-existent after a divorce. And so this gentleman, Guy, who committed this act of terror, very often experienced that kind of loss, meaninglessness, hopelessness, because he did not get what human children need to create and form that kind of stable life and stable foundation. Well, thank you for joining us for this weekend show. What we try to do here is give you a new perspective, a perspective on what's happening in the world, not from the perspective of adults, not based on even what politics, even what a conservative politician, even what the president would have you believe or want you to think. We want to turn you into children's rights champions. We want you to become defenders of kids. One of the ways that we do that is through our radio show. We often, as patients, you know, takes the lead, advocate for or educate lawmakers on good bills and bad bills that are facing different states. But we also work to create campaigns and awareness of children's fundamental rights to be known and loved by their mother and father. And right now we have a campaign at thembeforeus.com where you can help us raise money and become a monthly contributor for our And Not Or campaign so that we can defend the rights of children, 50% of whom grow up without their mom or dad. We'd love to have you join us there.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, joined by my engagement director at Them Before Us, Patience Sunny. We're going to talk about a few things that took place in the world of marriage and family and children over the past week. And the first thing we're going to discuss is the one big, beautiful budget bill that Trump and the Trump administration has been trying to pass. And so the spending bill did get voted out of the committee. And we want to pull on a few threads that directly connect to policy around marriage and family. So Patience, give us some of the highlights of what this bill, how this bill is going to connect with and hopefully incentivize the formation of more healthy families.
Yeah, so this bill is still a developing story. We're recording early in the week, so for our audience, there may be things that get updated between now and when the episode airs, but some big highlights in the bill. Pro-family supporters have really highlighted the way that the bill acts on the administration's promise to facilitate family formation, promote adoption, and benefit homeschool students or those who attend religious schools. So one of the things that's really been highlighted in this bill is preserving Trump's $2,000 child tax credit from his first term and increasing it by $500. So bumping that up to a $2,500 tax credit. Kina Gonzalez at the Family Research Council has highlighted the way that this is increasing the child tax credit and also making it permanent, pegging it to the amount of the tax credit to inflation so that it would continue going forward and be inflation adjusted. He said that, you know, this is excellent news for families in the current round of budgeting where they're trying to cut hundreds of billions of dollars. And this is really a huge nod to the importance of family. And he is right that it is noteworthy that the child tax credit got preserved in a bill where they're trying to balance, on the one hand, campaign promises about family formation benefits and wanting to promote policies that'll help families out as they're forming families, but also at the same time, wanting to help families out by keeping an eye on the national budget, because families are hurt if we just drive the nation further and further into debt. So this bill is really attempting to balance those two things. And one of the things that we'll be watching is whether the different wings of the Republican Party end up agreeing on whether the bill reaches that goal of balancing those things.
Yeah, I definitely have some concern about the debt. Very concerned about the debt. And the big, beautiful bill might include some big, beautiful things and even some things that connect with families, which we 100% love. But children are not helped by a massive federal debt. And it does look like the big, beautiful bill is going to contribute to that. We do have a chapter on debt in our book, Pro Child Politics. If you want to read a little bit more about why the debt crisis actually is a matter of justice for children, it was written by Phil Kirpin. So look up Pro Child Politics. Grab that. You'll get 3,000 tight words on the debt and why the debt is actually something that we need to consider when we're looking at bills like this. But like you said, Patience, what this bill communicates overall is that obviously marriage and family is a priority for this administration, and that we can say that we love. We love that they are looking at children, not just as drivers of the economy, which they 100% are. I mean, this whole problem that we're having with the population winter that is coming down the pike is going to be a big problem when it comes to not enough workers, especially supporting people that are on Social Security long-term. Like, our economy actually is not going to be able to function as it has with the kind of upside down triangle with so many people at the top and so few at the bottom. And so we do want to emphasize marriage and children for the economic reason, but that's not primarily what this is about. Not for us, hopefully not for the administration either. Children in and of themselves are a good. Children, whether or not they help or hurt the economy, are actually critical, not because they have something to give us, but because they are something that matters. Simply by being a human person, a member of the human family, they're valuable, they're precious, and they deserve to be welcomed. Like we talked about in the previous segment, abled or disabled, young or old, simply because you are a part of the human family, even if you're young, you have something that we need, and that is your dignity and your existence. So we like this. We like that the Trump administration is trying to, in whatever way they can, emphasize the importance of children and family. So There's also a little bit in this bill as it relates to adoption. So do you want to share a bit about that, Patience?
Yeah, so one of the provisions in the bill is really aimed at easing the process of adoption and promoting adoption through adoption grants for parents with a tax credit of up to $16,810 for qualified adoption expenses. And, you know, that's really addressing the fact that adoption can be expensive, but also adoption exists for kids. And it is a good thing for those children when they are placed in a safe and loving home. And part of the reason that the process is expensive is in order to make sure that the home a child is being placed in is safe, you have to go through a home study. You have to have those background checks. There's all of that process that's there for the sake of child protection, as it should be. But it can also create a barrier for families that would be very willing to welcome a child into a safe and loving home. And so this provision is aimed at attempting to address that and make it easier for families who would be good adoptive parents to adopt those children.
Well, I will tell you, the adoption tax credit was a huge help to us when we adopted. We felt very called to adopt, a very clear voice from God, go adopt. And I remember having this conversation with Jesus being like, okay, I totally got it. You want me to go? We don't have enough money right now. Like, we have about half as much in our bank account as we're going to need to do this adoption. It feels fiscally irresponsible for us to just go right now. I have no idea what we're not going to, we're not taking out loans, but like, we're not ready. And we felt like the need to just go. And so we did. And things got very, very lean. It got to the point where we're like, we need to sell some vehicles. You know, this, somebody had given us a car. We need to sell that car. We need to sell some furniture. Thankfully, God miraculously provided through all different kinds of ways. But by the time we got home with our son, we had like, I don't know, $700 in our bank account or something like that. And then we did end up getting the adoption tax credit, and like it filled the sales, like not SALES, but SAILS. It filled our financial sales again to the point where we weren't like totally destitute with four kids. So I actually really appreciate this tax credit. We don't want to simply pay this to adults to go through the process, because not every adult should have a child. But if you do go through the process and you are the right placement for a child in need and able to recoup some of those costs, is actually incredibly helpful. So anything else about this bill, Patience? I know that they have this really interesting sort of child savings account aspect to the Big Beautiful Bill. What's that all about?
Yeah, that is a really interesting aspect of the bill. So basically, it's designed to encourage parents to be saving money for their children's future. So parents with children younger than 8 can contribute up to $5,000 a year to money accounts for growth advancement, MAGA accounts. So the policy allows relatives, friends, employers, churches, nonprofits to donate to these accounts, which really creates an opportunity for pro-family employers to be able to contribute to these savings accounts for families' kids. The government would be depositing $1,000 in taxpayer money into these MAGA accounts for children born between 2024 and 2028, so during Trump's second term here. That's one of the provisions that's been a little controversial. There have been a few people asking questions, hey, is this genuinely helpful? Is this actually, like, are we pursuing the best interest of the next generation if the government's, you know, adding this spending through, you know, $1,000 per account, which I think is a valid question. But the accounts themselves do present an opportunity for families, friends, relatives, employers to be able to invest in the children of their employees, their friends, their family members.
Well, we can certainly have questions about the advantages or disadvantages of different kinds of programs in the Big Beautiful Bill, but I'll tell you one thing that there is no question about. This administration knows how to brand things. You know, the money accounts for growth and advancement, the MAGA accounts. I'm like, okay, well, that's what you get, I think, when you elect a TV personality star to the highest office. And you know what? It can be very helpful sometimes. So MAGA accounts, hopefully are going to redound to the benefit of children. Let's talk about a National Bureau of Economic Research report that just came out on divorce, family arrangements, and child outcomes. So we love studies. We love good studies here at Them Before Us. We like data. And, you know, it's so interesting because when you actually cut through the ideology, which unfortunately is dominating a lot of the social science these days, when you get down to the raw data, a funny thing happens. And that is, it proves the superiority of the natural family. When you look at anything where the methodology of the studies or where the raw information about outcomes for kids is taken into account, not with any kind of political spin, not with any kind of progressive push, but when you actually look at the raw experience of children, a funny thing rises to the top. And that is that children fare best when they're raised by their married biological mother and father in a permanent monogamous relationship known as marriage. So patients, tell us a little bit about this new divorce summary that was just released.
Yeah, so like you said, we like good studies, and this is a good study with a massive sample size. They studied tax and census records for over 5 million children. So, you know, that's a huge sample size for a study, and a lot of really good data in there. And the findings were not at all surprising, especially for those of us who have been keeping an eye on this topic, that divorce is not good for kids. But it is really good that we have good research that confirms that we can point to. So often when families divorce, the parents move apart. Parents are working longer hours as household income decreases because they're no longer relying on that dual income. Families often move more frequently after divorce and often to worse neighborhoods, again, because of that income hit that happens because of divorce. Nearly a third of American children suffer through divorce before adulthood, and we've actually found stats saying that as many as 50% of kids are not living with both of their biological parents by the time they reach adulthood. And that's a combination of divorce, cohabitative relationships that separated, children who were never raised by their biological parents because of adoption or donor conception. But that includes those kids of divorce. And the authors of the study observed sharp increases in teen births and child mortality among the kids of divorce. And again, these are trends that we were familiar with and aware of. There was already research indicating this, but to have a study of this size reinforcing that really drives home the effect of divorce on kids. They compared siblings with different lengths of exposure to the same divorce. So they're at different ages when the divorce happens, and they're looking at the way that different siblings are affected. And then also comparing, you know, divorce versus non-divorce. They found that divorce reduces children's earnings as adults, reduces likelihood of completing college, and increases incarceration rates. So really harmful across the board to kids, not just social outcomes, but also economic outcomes, public health outcomes, when we're seeing that increase in child mortality and increase in teen pregnancy among kids of divorce as well.
No surprise for those of us that spend any amount of time in the literature on the topic of family structure and family formation, but it is a slap in the face to the people that are trying to revive the narrative that kids don't need married parents, they just need happy parents. And our team at Them Before Us spends way too much time on Instagram looking through the profiles of especially women who are talking about how liberated they are from their marriage that did not involve abuse or alcoholism or even adultery. It's just, he wasn't doing the number of dishes that she wanted, or, you know, maybe she was like feeling hampered by the amount of housework that she had, or didn't feel like there was, they're not co-parenting the way she, because he is at work all day, girlfriend. And I don't know what it is, but there is now this like subgroup of Instagram moms, very often with journals to sell or programs to take that they can market to you if you too decide to leave your perfectly good marriage and shred your children's lives to the point where they might then, so that they might then think I'm a pro-mortalist and maybe I should go end the lives of unborn children before they can be born because you have sucked the life out of their family. And sometimes that can lead to nihilism on behalf of these kids. And so it's like if you look at one influencer and you're like, oh, her life looks so great. And look at, there's pictures of her at the beach with her children. They look like they're doing okay. Maybe I should get divorced too. Okay. Just be really honest with yourself. You are trading your children's long-term happiness, their financial health. You're even trading on the possibility of an earlier death and teen pregnancy for your kids. Just be really honest about what you're doing. You're having your happiness at the expense of their long-term physical health, mental health, relational health, financial health, emotional health, and maybe they'll die young. But hey, you can then purchase that fantastically monogrammed journal from the other divorce influencer who says she's living her best life now that she's free of that, you know, ball and chain husband who like just wanted to come home and spend time with her. And sorry, he can't do the work after, you know, being, you know, a plumber for 10 hours a day. And don't get me started. I'm started, but you know, I'm going to finish. The bottom line is divorce is bad for kids. We don't say it enough. We don't even say it enough in our churches. I was reading the Bible with my 15-year-old and we're reading through Matthew and we got to the point where Jesus was talking about, when is a divorce okay? And he's like, actually, never. And if you divorce, you commit adultery, you force your spouse to commit adultery. And he was like, holy, this is really harsh. I'm like, yeah, it's so interesting how the modern day church is so easy on divorce and Jesus absolutely was not. Why? Why wasn't he? Because of this. Because of this. Because it hurts kids, and there's no way to undo that hurt outside of him redeeming you, and sometimes not even then. So we're wrapping up this segment with a sorry that we hurt your feelings, but do what's best for kids anyway kind of thing. And if you want more information about that, come to thembeforeus.com, and we're happy to help you out. We are the people for you to tell you how to put kids first, even if it means sometimes you don't get what you want.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. If you are still reeling from the end of our last segment where I said, you need to avoid divorce at all costs because you're going to inflict a heavy burden on your children, thanks for giving us another chance to trigger you again. But really, I know that there's really difficult situations out there when it comes to struggling marriages. And we absolutely are against casual divorce, divorce where you think, well, I could do better, or I'm not fulfilled, or my children would rather have me happy than married to their father or their mother. We absolutely are the place that will confront that. But we also recognize that there are situations where a divorce might be necessary if there's abuse taking place, or at least a separation if there's real serious patterns of unhealth. And in those kinds of scenarios, we pray that you will have good community, good pastors, good therapists, accountability partners who are going to step in. And instead of simply escaping the marriage or ditching the marriage, that you heal and revive and allow the marriage to flourish, not just for your sake, but for the sake of your children. So we are going to spend the next few minutes tackling some of the questions that we have sourced around the internet in the last week. And as always, to do that, I have my training director, Jen Friesen, here, who runs all of our social media. So if you follow us on Instagram or on X or on Facebook, you can thank Jen for that. She is absolutely getting the message out there. A lot of people's eyes are being open, and a lot of people are getting very, very angry. Because we talk about how, hey, just because you want a kid doesn't mean that you can assemble one by purchasing sperm, egg, and womb, and then denying it a mother or father throughout their life. So that makes some people angry, and Jen deals with a lot of that backlash. So give Jen a hip hip and a ray for me, and I will welcome her back to the show.
Hey, Katie. It is pretty funny because I've gotten, you know, a message from the same person across, maybe it'll come to your social media and then it'll come to our Them Before Us social media and it'll come to whatever. And it's the same person, me, reading it each time. And I kind of get a bit of satisfaction, this idea that I help take out the trash. So people think that you have to go and look through your messages and get all these hateful comments and stuff. And it's like, Katie is too busy to be in these comments, just so you know, I handle it. We laugh about it as a staff when people send us nasty stuff because it doesn't bother us. I mean, it's 2025 and the name calling doesn't really work anymore to silence us. So
you can only call people homophobes and transphobes and racists and white supremacists so many
bigots.
Times. Yeah. Yeah. Before people are like, yeah, it's kind of lost its power.
Right. Well, and I just love the line you say, biology isn't bigotry. I mean, we just keep coming back to that. I'm actually not doing this because I hate anybody. We just care about kids more than we care about your feelings about people in the comments, right? But also, I don't want to overstate the negative because we get so many positive comments, so many great stories, even people sharing hard things that still agree with our message and appreciate us. So we're so thankful to be doing this work and have a platform at all. And there is never a lack of content online or from comments and questions that we get. So I did find some really interesting questions that I'd love your take on for our audience today. The first one is from a guy. He says, am I a bad guy for being hesitant to adopt my fiance's 12-year-old son? I already love and treat him like my own. He's even in my will, but I have 3 kids of my own. I'm going through a long, expensive legal process to adopt my fiance's son, especially when his biological dad is still around. Feels like too much, but the fiance might cancel the wedding if he says no to adoption. So what would be, and this kind of goes back to, why do we advocate for marriage? Why do we advocate for sticking in your marriage and raising your children together? Things start to get really messy when it's just this endless cycle of so-and-so's kids from another marriage, baby daddies, adoption, step-siblings, et cetera. But this is a complex situation. How would we engage with this?
I think there's a couple commendable things about the situation. Number one, the guy can be commended for treating this child with dignity, with love, as a father who hopefully is going to do what he can to be the right kind of father figure in the life of the child. We can commend the mother for saying, this relationship is not just about me. This involves my child. And so both of these things are really, really important because a lot of people come to us. We talk a lot about the dangers and disadvantages of step families. And so people will come to us and say, well, should I get remarried? Should I start dating even though I'm divorced, even though I'm a single mother? And the answer is maybe and maybe not. But whoever you choose, you have got to have an eye, not just to do they emotionally fulfill me, but also to, are they going to be the person that is going to protect, invest in, and connect with my child? Because as we know, unrelated men and women in the home overall decrease the child well-being, decrease investment. There's less connection and sometimes increase the risk of abuse and neglect. So it's good that both of these adults are understanding that the child has a vested interest in this process as well. A lot of this does come down to the child's biological father, who it sounds like is still in the picture. So this is where I'm like, I don't have enough information here. But if the biological father is still in the picture, he has something important that that boy needs. He has biological identity. He's got a history. He's got connection, kinship, and heritage, something that connects the child to his broader extended family. Those are things that you cannot simply cut out of the child's life and think, well, the kid's going to be okay. So what you have here is a problem where the child's going to lose, sounds like, one way or the other. They already lost when his parents divorced. Maybe that was for justifiable reasons. Maybe there really was something significantly wrong, like abuse, in which case we would hope that the person that was doing the abusing would get punished and no longer have custody. But the child still wants that knowledge of and wants as much as possible, as much as is healthy, a relationship with their biological father. So this is a situation where it's like, if the stepfather is a really good guy and the bio dad is a dirtbag, well, maybe you can look at the justification for that, but it sounds like that's not the case. It sounds like everyone needs to be honest with this boy about the limbo that the adults in his life have placed him in, and that there really is not going to be wholeness anywhere he looks. No amount of adult, unless the biological mom and dad got back together, mended their relationship, there really is no way for this boy to experience wholeness, even though it sounds like the mom and the stepfather, the fiance's hearts are in the right place.
Yeah, that's good. The next question is from a woman. She asks, am I wrong for telling my boyfriend I want to take the lead on raising our baby because I don't want her to grow with the same entitled attitude as his 14-year-old daughter from a previous relationship? And then she describes the daughter wears only designer clothes, has never done a chore. She puts this squarely on the boyfriend's shoulders. So I'm not sure about the mom, if the mom's still in the picture. My boyfriend says, I'm being unfair and is now upset with me, but I just want to raise our child with different values. Was I out of line for saying I want to take the lead in raising our child?
I don't know where to begin with how many things are wrong with this scenario, but let's give it a try. Number one, don't you be talking about children until you're married. I mean, it's good to have an idea that you're on the same page when it comes to raising kids. But don't talk about having a child with a guy you're not married to, because very soon you will be an unmarried single mother. If he is not, I mean, especially because he has done this before. There already is a scenario where either it didn't work out or he chose for it not to work out. Thankfully, it sounds like he still has a relationship with the child from his first or previous relationship. Wonderful. But that girl, that 14-year-old, I honestly will say, probably feels entitled, probably does have a lot of material goods thrown her way, probably doesn't do a lot of chores. And maybe that's because mom and dad feel guilty. And sometimes they try to buy her off instead of instructing her and encouraging her and exhorting her to step into the role of a responsible, mature adolescent. So I've seen this a lot in divorce situations where especially the non-custodial parent, kind of out of guilt and because they don't have a lot of time to spend, they'll just spend money on the kid instead. And then, yeah, the kid does start to feel kind of entitled to things, when the reality is they're starving for connection. And so do not repeat the mistake of this first relationship, the first relationship that did not put them before us, that did not ensure that the child was known, loved, raised by their own married mother and father. And I'm not blaming the kid for this. I'm blaming the original mom and dad who did not work it out. And so they probably did try to make up for what the child was lacking by taking her to Disneyland or buying her designer shoes. And the truth is, I bet that just exacerbated the problem because she's starving for connection and all she's getting is materialism. What do you think, Jen?
It's a really great thing to think through all the questions you need to ask before you marry someone, before you have children with them. You know, in this scenario, if you're pregnant already, and now you're like, well, we have different values, so I want to take the lead. That's a problem. There were many steps before that you should have handled. I think there's a book called 100 Questions You Ask Before You Get Married or 1,000 Questions You Ask Before You Get Married. Have you heard of it? Is it religious, Christian?
No, I don't know. The one that I'm thinking about is 35 Questions to Fall in Love.
Oh.
So I've got like the wrong question list going on in my head.
There's resources. I think the one that says 100 or 1,000 questions to ask tries to cover everything. Finances. How are we going to handle debt? How are we going to donate to charitable causes? How are we going to discipline? What's our boundaries with in-laws? Because there's a lot of people that, especially if we haven't seen good marriages, we don't know the way to go about it. But asking questions and getting counseling and premarital counseling and having a faith community and having healthy people in your life, vetting the person you're looking into and want to date, are all so important before you get to this point, like you said. And they're playing at marriage without being married. Mm-hmm. But you don't have the security. You're not on the same team. Here's the shared values that we have and how we've decided we're going to have our family operate. They're roommates with benefits and they probably Venmo each other for bills. And then they decide who's going to parent which kids. It's just, that's not the way it's supposed to be. And of course, women don't feel safe in this scenario. Men don't feel safe in this scenario, you know? So it's just not the way it's supposed to be. And don't get into that situation because it's much more complex after the child is born.
Yeah, totally agree. And in terms of, can I take the lead? Can I do this? Honey, you do not understand how parenting works if that's the approach. You have got to be on the same page. It's not like you're going to be in charge. And no, that's not how it works. He's going to have different ideas about this, and those ideas are going to benefit the child. So you need to be aligned in terms of worldview, aligned in terms of values and principles. And then after that, you're going to go kind of day by day, year by year, season by season, and say, what about now? How about now? How do we do it now? But you cannot do that if you're not exactly on the same page.
Okay, for our final question, a young woman asks, how do you heal after ending a 14-year relationship that started back in high school? I think she's in her early 20s now, so kind of young couple to date. We basically grew up together, but we broke up because he didn't want to get married. Even though it was mutual, I'm feeling a deep sadness, questioning my worth. My career is taking off, but it feels empty without someone to share it with.
All right. So this is very, very important, young ladies. If you are here, if you are listening to me and you're 18, 22, 25, 27, you cannot allow a guy to chew up your critical marriage and childbearing years by delaying, delaying, delaying. He is stealing from you. And the truth is, he's probably stealing from you because you are giving him sex. So if you want a guy who is decisive, you withhold yourself sexually. Bottom line, you say no when he wants to engage in a sexual relationship, especially if you like him and especially if you want him to like you. I've told my girls from forever and all the girls in youth group, men value what they work for and they work for what they value. Part of the ways that he is going to work for you is by moving towards marriage. But if he does not have any incentive to work towards marriage, and like it or not, sex is part of that incentive. If you have taken that incentive off the table, there's no reason for him to commit. And then he will use you for whatever financial benefits that you have to offer, the sexual benefits for sure that you have to offer, or maybe just like the low bar of now he doesn't have to go out and like look for somebody else. So do not be in this woman's situation. I feel for this woman. The reason why you're feeling so sad is because you did emotionally invest. If you had sex with him, which I'm sure 14-year relationships do not happen if you are not having sex. So that's just how it is, okay? What you do when you have sex is you are chemically bonding with him. The oxytocin is exchanged. It increases when you are having sex. The oxytocin communicates to you, ladies, to your body, I belong with him. We're going to be together forever. You know, now he has a part of me. And that is true. But when the guy is transient and he is not permanent and then he leaves, he takes you with him and you are in the gutter. You feel like you're in the gutter. So, ladies, do not allow a guy to consume the years when you are primed for marriage and motherhood. He has stolen 14 years from this girl's life, where now she has to start over in a time where she's going to have more obstacles when she does get married and when she does have children in her 30s or early 40s. Do not follow in her footsteps, ladies. Figure it out early. Be very, very judicial. And honestly, get your mother involved. She will help you.
Yeah, it's marriage benefits for the man without the marriage benefits for the woman. Because for women, it's security. We're on the same team. You're promising to provide for me and our children for the rest of our lives. For men, it's sexual intimacy. It's you're doing my laundry and you're cooking and cleaning. And if you're, you know, you're engaged in that level of relationship for 14 years, all those things are probably occurring, you know, and if you're living together. So I agree with everything you're saying.
Well, I'll tell you, it is a vicious dating world out there. I have recently started a little matchmaking service just in my free time with people that I know, and it's hard. Girls are having a hard time finding great guys. Guys are having a hard time finding great girls. So I'm not saying that it's easy, but dating done well is really important. And I'll tell you one thing, do not spend 14 years or even 4 years with somebody that isn't willing to give themselves completely to you. Thanks for being with us, and we will see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.